Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the September 20th broadcast of Italian Tomatoes. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Italian Tomatoes. I'm your host, Bob Curie. It is Friday, September 20th, and Sunday, September 20th. And tonight we're going to discuss the state of the presidential campaign. We're going to look at the Republican race post-debate, and we're also going to take a look at the dilemma that is besetting Hillary Clinton. The chat is open if you wish to see, if you wish to participate in the chat. I see Larry in the chat. Welcome to him. And the phones are open for anybody who wants to call in. The number is 646-478-0004. That's 646-478-0004. The show is scheduled for 90 minutes. It may be shorter if depending on the amount of participation we get. I do have some points to run through. But before we get going on that, I just want to note a couple of things. First, this is the last show of the summer. Fall starts in the middle of next week. And, of course, as the cooler weather sets in, the political activity gets more intense. So we will see more and more news stories about the Republican and Democratic races for president. And then I just wanted to recount a personal experience. I was doing some reading. I like to go to one of the local parks at lunchtime and have my lunch there and do some reading. And yesterday, there was in the one of the parks, the park where I went, there was a picnic held by what they called an organization called COPS, COPS, which is the Concerns of Police Survivors. And this is a fraternal organization that is dedicated to the concerns of police survivors. So as I'm sitting in my car reading, there was a picnic and gathering going on not too far from where I was sitting. And it really makes you think. I mean, because many of these people are family and friends of fallen police officers killed in the line of duty. And looking at the attendees and their kids, they were white, they were black, they were Hispanic. And they had, not terribly good luck with the weather. It was raining, but then it cleared up, and we had kind of a beautiful Indian summer afternoon. And, you know, the kids were playing and, you know, on the playgrounds, the slides and the swings and all that stuff, and, you know, doing softball and related activities like that. And, you know, they're obviously having a good time, but there was just an element of sadness watching all of that because, you know, you know what brought that about. I mean, it was the deaths of police officers. And I went to the COPS website and, you know, took a look at what this organization does. And, you know, they remarked that there are over 100 cops a year die in the line of duty. And that really gives you some pause, especially with all the controversy surrounding the police these days, more often than not inflamed by the mass media. You know, 100 cops a year or more, you know, 120, 130, 140, you know, 10 years go by, you have lost the equivalent of the fatalities in a small war. So, Blue Lives Matter. I mean, in all of the controversies that we have today regarding the police, and God knows they are not perfect, we need to remember the big picture, which is a lot of these guys and women put their lives on the line for us, and some of them pay the ultimate price. So something to consider. Okay, want to take a look at chat, see if anything needs attention there, or the phone line. I think I have a caller, and I think I know who this caller is, but let's see. Area code 810. Who are you?
Hey.
I thought that was you. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Long time.
Long time. What have you been up to in the past few years? This is Miss M, by the way, for our listeners.
Well, you know, I've been raging against the machine as per usual.
What is there possibly to complain about?
Oh my gosh!
Have you been attending clearance sales for Obama merchandise, or you know, picking up stuff at a bargain?
Yeah, you know, I love my Obama tchotchkes.
And are your relatives still drinking the Kool-Aid?
They're not gulping it down anymore; they're just sipping on it. But you know. To be honest with you, it's because of the whole first black president thing, and they don't know how to, you know, really let that go. So, but I've heard a few little criticisms here and there. One of them got to meet him, and he was starstruck and all that, but then same relative also likes Trump. So this is, it's an interesting little disconnect there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, and we're actually going to go into that particular aspect of Trump's candidacy, which is, you know, the polling indicates that he is taking a sliver of the black vote, potentially. I mean, polls are just polls. You never know until
right.
You actually have an election and people show up and push the lever. But he does have some crossover appeal, and that has got to have the Democrats worried. And I think if those poll soundings continue, he will be they will have an enormous incentive to try to take him out. Usually with the help of their allies and the media, so that's something to really keep an eye out on. Well, we're going
to. Well, when you get to that portion, I'll tell you what I think, because I don't think the media will be as effectual as they have been in the past. So we'll talk about that when you get through with your.
I think you're probably right about that. The way the show is organized, I'm going to just discuss two things. One is Hillary's campaign, which will be fairly short, and then we'll go into the whole thing with the debates and Trump and all the rest of it. The interesting thing about Hillary, and I guess I'll launch my Hillary theme right now, which is... For those who remember the 2008 campaign and the 3 a.m. phone call, this is the theme I've dedicated to Hillary. Hillary is obviously having some problems, and of course there's her legal problems with related to the email server and the confidentiality of classified information, and that is of course largely a legal affair, and as a non-lawyer I don't feel particularly competent to talk about it. I would say that a lot of her trouble would not be happening without at least the tacit consent of highly placed people in the Obama administration. And where it will all turn out, I don't know. But the broader problem for Hillary is she has no base anymore. The Clintons threw their natural base away. And, you know, if you remember, when you go back to the 1990s, Bill Clinton was elected as a centrist Democrat who championed a more active role for government while also responding to middle-class concerns and values. And he offered a vision of government that could assist the middle class on issues like the deficit, crime, support for the police, economic growth, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And like any politician, I mean, he had to navigate among the different constituencies of the Democratic Party. He would move left, he would move right, he would go to the center. But it remained essentially true that he was a centrist Democrat until the impeachment crisis. And then he was fighting for his life, and he needed support, and where he found it was on the left of the party. And the Democratic Party has been moving left ever since the impeachment crisis. When Hillary ran in 2008, she ran to the left of where Clinton was before 1998, but she did represent some continuity with the Clinton centrism, and her natural base was working-class Americans with some feminists thrown in. But and you saw that repeatedly in the primaries, where the Obama people were the coalition of college kids and lefty radicals, and of course, you know, African Americans who saw the prospect for the first black president. Hillary was drawing her support from, you know, the more traditional parts of the Democratic base, working class people, union people, people like that. And in the fight for the control of the party, Obama's people were just better and better placed to get control of the party machinery than Hillary's people were, because Hillary was largely supported by working people who had full-time jobs, whereas Obama's people, the community activists, the students, the, you know, the kind of permanent lefty activist class, they had the time to go to the caucuses to, you know, schmooze and cajole and argue. And over time, they won control of the party machinery in the caucus states. And even though Hillary beat Obama in the popular votes in the primaries, the Obama people won control of the Democratic Party and thus the delegates and then, of course, the nomination itself. Now, what happened after the election of 2008 is very interesting, because I don't think the Clintons ever knew that they ever realized that what they should have done was to cultivate the base that they already had. What they did instead was try to ingratiate themselves with Obama and his base by reversing most of their policy stance of the 1990s. And they did that during the George Bush years, and then especially during the Obama years, on things like deficits, gay marriage, Iraq, police, crime, whatever. They abandoned all of their centrist positions, and they kind of adopted the Obama line, hoping, I think, to create an IOU that Obama was going to honor. And as it is very clear now, Obama still hates the Clintons. He does not feel any indebtedness towards them for their support in 2008 and in 2012 when he was really in trouble and he really relied on the Clintons to shore up, his support among the alienated parts of the Democratic Party. So right now, Hillary is baseless. She has no natural constituency because no one trusts her. No one knows what she stands for, what she really thinks, because, like I say, she kind of repudiated all of the policy stands that the Clintons took during the 90s and the Bush years. The left doesn't trust her because they remember the centrism, and the centrists don't trust her because they see how far she tacked left. So she is left with this festering email scandal, and she has no support. So so you think that's pretty on base as far as an analysis?
Absolutely. I mean, I said it, and I say this as a porter. Everything you've outlined right there from a centrist standpoint and a person who has been independent for all of her voting life, everything you said, at least for me, is absolutely accurate. I saw her as nothing at that point but a politician willing to change her values on a whim to try and secure more votes for herself. And as someone who believed that they had more character than that, I was highly disappointing. The worst thing she did was hitch her wagon to Obama. I said that during the 2008 cycle. I said that when she accepted the appointment as Secretary of State. And then after that, that was it. And so everything since then, to me, for the Clintons, has been a downward spiral. And why they believed that Barack Obama's stripes weren't the stripes that he always had since day one, that he would play ball and get along and do the thing, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Why they would believe that, that also shows like a naivete that these seasoned politicians shouldn't have. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He has never changed his far left ways of thinking. Not even one iota. He hated them then. He hated them when she was Secretary of State. He hated them in 2012, and he hated them. He hates them now. And I agree with you completely. If it was one of his handlers or not, I tend to believe it was Obama himself. I said, we're going to sink this bitch and release those emails.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, Dick Morris, and I have a clip from him that I'm going to play on the debate. Dick Morris had another one of his videos where he said, all of Hillary's email stuff and the attitude of the Department of Justice, this could not be happening without approval from the very top of the Obama administration. Yeah. It simply could not be happening. And, who specifically, I don't know, but it's coming from the very top. Either it's Michelle or Valerie Jarrett or Obama himself. But as far as being Secretary of State, now I think what she should have done in 2008 was to have stayed in the Senate and to cultivate her own political following. And
yeah.
and you know, and be like the honest, you know, the devil's advocate type of role, where she would support Obama when when she thought he was right, and opposed him when she thought he was wrong.
Right. Then she could have it. She could split it both ways to the middle.
Right.
And she wouldn't have lost all of the the Clinton, their Reagan Democrats. She wouldn't have lost those. She wouldn't have lost the Reagan Democrats that were for Clinton.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the coalition she should have been cultivating, as well as she had to know, considering his far left views, he was going to disenfranchise and piss off many of his coalition, which is why they're just kind of, but for the few stragglers that want to hold on and pretend, you know, the social justice warriors, the SJWs, for the most part, the young people are like, he hasn't done anything for us and hadn't helped us in any way. She could have been there to pick up those people.
Yeah,
but absolutely. Now they're just twisting in the wind.
Well, you know, if you were 19, let's choose a better number. If you were 22, not college grad in 2008, and you got on the Obama Pied Piper Express, you know,
mm-hmm.
in 2016, you're going to be 30. You still don't have a job. You're probably
mm-hmm.
living at home. You've got all of the student debt. And, you know, and your life is, you know, your youth is over. I mean, you're still young at 30, but you're not 20 anymore. A lot of the things that people hopefully do in their 20s haven't happened for these people, the younger generation. I mean, they're not established. They don't have careers. They're not self-sufficient. They're relying on parents and roommates to keep a roof over their head. You know, they're on their parents' health insurance till age 26. And with Obamacare, they're dependent on government subsidies to have any kind of health insurance, or they get slammed with the health care tax. I mean, it is not a pretty picture for the young people. And like you say, if she had stayed in the Senate, she could have addressed all of this. But, you know, she became Secretary of State, which meant she had to sign on to his foreign policy agenda, which has been a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, she's had to at least consent to his domestic agenda, which has also been a disaster. So what do you run on?
Yeah, exactly. You know, she had to know, which is why I said no one can trust her now, that Obama, you know, I know this isn't popular to say, but he hates America. And what I mean is they love an America that they want to remake. They want to remake America in their image, but they hate the America as is, warts and all.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't play apologist for American history, but I don't say that American history is at its roots evil. They believe that. They believe the reason why we have been at the seat of power, because I hesitate to say that we still are, because they're doing their very best to undo everything. But the reason why we have, to their view, the reason why we're at the seat of power is because we've stolen something from everyone else. And we don't deserve to be here because of what we've stolen from everyone else. Ignoring the fact that sometimes successful nations are successful and sometimes nations that are not as successful are that because of their leadership, not because another nation stole something from someone. And so his whole thing is he wants to give back. He wants to take chunks out of this country and give back to everybody else. He would love nothing more for us to be taken down notches, which is what he's been doing, so that we are on a quote-unquote even keel with those nations that we've stolen from.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's fine with us to have a third world or insignificant status on the world stage. It won't harm him or his. I mean, he said it. He and his family will be fine.
Yeah.
We're
yeah, it really is outrageous that he's willing to accept that lower standard of living, lower level of national security. For you know, he's not only doing that to Republicans; he's doing it for the people to the people who voted for him. But he doesn't give a hoot.
Of course, it won't touch him. He'll live in his gated communities. He'll make millions around the world giving speeches, much like the Clintons. His family will be taken care of by the Secret Service in perpetuity, I guess, until someone comes in and takes that out of there, maybe. But the whole thing is that he's set. So what does he care about the rest of us? He's fine with Rome burning.
Yeah.
He's sitting there with his fiddle.
And what Hillary should have done, and you know, I want to move on to the debate, but what Hillary should have done, I think she should have stayed in the Senate, but if she was going to be Secretary of State, she should have done it for like 18 months to say, look, I opposed him, but I wanted to get him off on a good start. So I'll do it for a year or two, and then I'll move on, you know, to pursue other opportunities. Maybe she could have run for office again, or she could have done, you know, founded some movement or something to give her another platform to reach the public. But by hanging in there for 4 years, culminating in Benghazi, showed a very stupid strategic sense, and what you want in a president is somebody who has a good strategic sense. So I really think she shot herself in the foot by agreeing to be Secretary of State, and once she agreed, she should have known when to get out, which was 2 years max. And, you know, she hung in there for the four, and of course the last final year is what Benghazi happened. And Benghazi opened up the Pandora's box about her email server, and, you know, she is where she is, twisting in the wind.
Oh, I know. It's like at every turn he's done his level best to put his thumb in her eye, and she, oblivious or whatever, I don't understand, like you said. For people who are supposed to be some of the most cutthroat politicians on the planet Earth, they have displayed a naivete that, you know.
That's actually a really good point. It's amazing how naive the Clintons were. I mean, the Clintons had enormous popularity in the Democratic Party, and they had it even while Obama was seizing the party machinery, because, like I said, his operatives were better placed to attend caucuses and get control of delegates. But the Clintons had an enormous natural base, and they threw it all away. I do not understand it. I just don't understand how somebody as bright as Bill Clinton, I mean, I don't think Hillary is as bright as Bill, but she's no dummy either. I don't know how
I mean, right, he's politically astute, and it was just like, for whatever reason, they had this whole blind spot when it came to Obama.
Yeah, I think it goes back maybe to, they just couldn't stand the idea of somebody being more trendy and popular with young people, and, you know, because they had... They flirted with liberalism in their youth, you know, left liberalism, and I just think that they couldn't stand the idea that they were being portrayed as sellouts and materialists. They wanted to get that sheen back of being trendy reformers, and, you know, hey, you got to grow up.
Exactly.
Well, anyway, let's move on to the debate, and for the benefit of the people listening in archives, I'm going to play a clip of Dick Morris with his, I really like Dick Morris's commentary, so this is a fairly long clip when he gives his reactions to the debate, who won and who lost. So I don't know if I'll play the whole thing, but I'll run most of it. So here it is.
Who won and who lost the debate? Well, who won the debate is pretty simple. Donald Trump. Lots of the establishment figures are anxious to say that Kasich or Fiorina may have prevailed or may have done well, may have stolen some of Trump's thunder. But Donald Trump thundered, and he kept center stage, and he won. He has now handled himself very well over a long period of time and sustained his front-runner status. He sustained it yesterday, in particular, by manifesting a certain judiciousness in the use of military force, saying that he had opposed the intervention in Iraq and saying that he would be very deliberate before he would commit American forces. I think the defect that Trump has in these debates and everywhere else is that he just insults people too much. I mean, Fiorini's face, Rubio's voting record, almost everything about Bush. And I don't think he looks good when he does that. And I don't think it particularly helps him vis-a-vis those other candidates. When he insults the Iranians and goes after Obama, that all makes sense. But I think that, and I wonder if that insult is going to begin to wear on people. But not now. Right now, Donald Trump is doing great and is the front runner and deserves to be. Now, underneath Trump, a lot's going on, and we need to pay attention to it because, you know, we don't know what the future is going to bring. Start with the main story, which is the alternative to Trump was increasingly Ben Carson, who had been moving up and up and up and had closed to within 5 points of him in the national polling. I think Carson, number one, really disappointed. I think he was way too understated, not strong enough. But I think what really killed him was opposing going after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and going after al-Qaeda. His answer that what he would do was to have a great big national effort for energy independence was pathetic. Yeah, we need energy independence, and yeah, that's going to cripple terrorism, but that's a 10-year strategy. In the meantime, we had to stop these people from knocking down our buildings. And in my mind, that disqualified him for the presidency. I just do not see him as a viable candidate. If he lingers with good poll ratings, those will be knocked apart as soon as people really absorb what he said later in the debate about Afghanistan. That was in the third hour, but it'll really, I think, destroy his candidacy. Now, in the center stage, that is the moderates and the Republicans as opposed to the conservatives, Jeb Bush has always been the dominant figure. And we have watched week after week, month after month, as Bush has reduced and dropped in stature. It's not the free fall that Hillary is going through, but nevertheless, it's point by point by point. Last night he seemed dwarfed by Trump, which is odd because he's about 3 inches taller than Trump and certainly stands straighter. But Bush was just, I thought, pitiful in dealing with Trump. He sounded squeaky, marginalized. Trump had the better of him in all of those exchanges. And I think that in the side-to-side of Bush and Trump, Bush just looks terrible. If he was some other place on the platform, maybe it would be better. But head-to-head, toe-to-toe, literally, I just don't think he measures up. And I think he looks weaker than he probably is. But he does not look to me like the guy who can run the country. He needed to be transcendent to overcome everybody. All of these others are pygmies. I'm Bush. Just did not even begin to measure up to that, even vis-a-vis the others, and certainly vis-a-vis Trump. And Bush now has strong competition from Carly Fiorina, who I thought did a very good job and was quite credible and could really challenge Bush for that centrist, moderate Republican nomination. She also has some appeal on the right, and as a woman, her appeal transcends all ideologies. But I think that she could be very effective. I was disturbed by her refusal to go along with the change of the anchor baby law and her reluctance on deportation. But she is running really more as a moderate than a conservative, and I think that she really represents a significant challenge to Bush. And the other challenge to Bush in the centrist ring, or the semi-final court, if you will, is from Kasich and from Christie. Kasich, I thought, did very well. I disagree with him on almost everything. He opposed deportation. He said that he would not rip up the Iranian agreement. He said ripping it up would be irresponsible. I think he's way wrong on those issues. But he was outspoken, and he's aggressive and with a good record as governor. Christie, who had been eclipsed by Trump, really, as the truth-telling, blunt-talking New Jersey governor, had a comeback, I think. And I think that as Bush loses votes, you can look for Christie and Kasich and Fiorina to begin to pick up some of that slack and move into competition with Bush. Now, number one, I don't think that Bush will ultimately survive that competition. And number two, I don't think that the winner of that competition will be nearly as strong in facing the conservatives as Bush would have been, because they're not going to have the same money or the same establishment pedigree. You can almost feel the establishment of the Republican Party shifting from Bush to Kasich. And I think that's a trend that will go on over the next couple of months. But I don't think that Kasich can win this nomination with the positions that he's taken. Now, on the conservative side of the spectrum, the big news here was, of course, the collapse of Ben Carson. And that's going to free lots of voters, many of them conservative, to flow into the existing conservative candidates. And among those candidates, I felt that Cruz was brilliant, eloquent. He didn't speak as much as the others did, but every time he spoke, it was with authority and dignity and a factual predicate that I thought was very impressive. I think that Rubio was very impressive. For the first time, I saw him taking good positions and strong positions and advocating them with vigor. I'm concerned about Rubio's ability to survive his opposition to amnesty and his sponsoring of the Gang of Eight immigration resolution. As a Latino, he would be particularly vulnerable on that score. I think that Walker underwhelmed. I think that he continues to have a much better record in Wisconsin than he's able to manifest in these debates. So that's kind of the field. I think, and I'm sorry, excuse me, Mike Huckabee was very strong, very good. But again, Mike comes across a little bit as almost background music in these races. He's not the cutting edge, upfront guy that he so often is. Part of it is that he has to face competition from Cruz and Carson and Rubio and other candidates, but Santorum, I guess. But Mike needs to get it together a lot more and be articulate on a range of issues, not just Iran, which he was brilliant, and not just social conservatism. So when you put it all together, I think that Trump will remain in the lead. I think Fiorina will have a surge and maybe take second place. But I think in the long term, Fiorina, Kasich, and Christie combined can bring Bush down. And I think it's going to be between Cruz and Rubio for the main conservative berth. But keep an eye on Huckabee. He can always come up. Thanks for watching.
Okay. I decided to play the whole thing because he made a lot of good points, and I agree, you know, with most of it. I mean, I think that Bush is clearly flailing. He just doesn't come across all that powerfully on television, and you know, Bush has just this enormous family baggage that he has to carry around with him from his brother's administration. And the whole dynastic thing and all the rest of it. So plus Bush's own positions, especially on immigration and Common Core, are really poison for many conservatives. And conservatives will accept a moderate, but there are limits to how moderate that moderate can be. And I think on immigration, which turned out to be such a hot-button issue this time, thanks to Donald Trump having the balls to make it an issue. Immigration. Donald Trump just changed the whole term of the debate of the race by taking the stance on immigration that he did. So, very interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I think, you know, my take on, I was working that night, so I have had, I've watched pieces of the debate on tape, and, you know, my impression was that Trump didn't shine, but he held his own, and that's all he has to do, because his brand image is so powerful outside of anything that goes on the debate stage. He just has to, all he needs to do in a debate is to not contradict the image he projects outside of the debate. And I think that he succeeded in doing that. Now, the media is really pumping up Carly Fiorina, and this is the thing that I wanted to talk about, especially this evening, this afternoon, about Carly. A lot of people criticize Trump because of what they perceive as flip-flops that he has made on policy over the years. And it's true. I mean, you know, he is a businessman, headquartered in a very liberal state. He made lots of donations to Democratic politicians. He had lots of contacts through his business activities with Democratic and liberal politicians. And, you know, that the company that you keep influences, you know, what you think and what you talk about and what you believe. And in his younger days, I mean, Trump took many positions that would not be considered by any stretch of the imagination conservative. And so a lot of conservatives, and you see this on Twitter, bash him for this constantly. And for some reason, they have decided, because they hate Trump, that they're going to push Carly Fiorina. But Carly Fiorina has done exactly the same thing. And there was a she also made her mark in a liberal state in California. That's where she ran businesses. She ran for public office in California. In order to run for public office, she had to take positions that are definitely out of sync with the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And there is a very good article about Carly's kind of evolution from a classic liberal Republican to what she is now on Red State, written by Strife. And good article, and I'm going to put it in chat. For anybody who wants to look at that, let me get it over there now. Post that. But my problem with Carly Fiorina is kind of special because I'm a Hewlett-Packard shareholder, and that stock has been one of the worst I've ever owned, and negligence has kept me from selling it. I should have sold it years ago. When Carly Fiorina was chairman, a CEO of Hewlett Packard. She was CEO from 1999, the middle of 1999 to 2005. And she engineered a merger with Compaq Computer that turned out to be a really bad transaction. It wrecked the corporate culture of Hewlett Packard and led to tremendous job losses. And the merged company simply did not perform well, and she was ousted by her board. And having done something as traumatic in terms of the corporate culture as the merger with Compaq, she set in motion a chain of events with subsequent CEOs where HP is a shadow of what it used to be. And under its current management, Meg Whitman, HP has announced plans for another 30,000 layoffs, and they are breaking up the company into three pieces, which will become independent of one another. So you had, you know, Carly Fiorina go into Hewlett Packard in 99. She left in 2005 with the company in complete disarray with no succession plan. Following her, the subsequent CEOs embroiled the company in more underperformance, more corporate scandals, more turnover of top executives, and more layoffs, culminating in what's going on under Meg Whitman. So if you're contrasting the business success of Trump to the business performance of Carly Fiorina, to me, there's no contest. Trump wins hands down. He built his business legacy is a lasting accomplishment, whereas Carly Fiorina has largely left behind wreckage. Now, no matter how well she performs on television, there is no getting away from it. And don't think for a minute that the Democrats who made such an issue of Romney being involved in restructurings in 2012, that they aren't going to hammer Fiorina for the layoffs and the restructurings and the outsourcing that happened on her watch. So that's the main point I want to make. I just saw a comment from Larry in the chat. I know Larry, but I had to, in objectivity, post the link. So Republicans, and then the other thing with Carly is, now obviously she has appeal as a woman candidate, I understand that, and that appeal is kind of calibrated to the assumption that Hillary is going to be the Democratic candidate. But I just don't know if Hillary is going to be the Democratic candidate.
Exactly.
And so again, strategically, if you're supporting Carly because you want to have a woman to go up against Hillary as a woman, if Hillary isn't the candidate, I mean, you have just made a strategic giant miscalculation. And so before a lot of anti-Trumpers in the Republican Party get on the Carly bandwagon, they need to cool their jets for a few months and see what really happens to Hillary's candidacy. Because it makes no sense to run somebody like Carly with the baggage that she's going to carry into the campaign if Hillary is not the nominee on the other side. So that's kind of the main point I wanted to make about Carly. But now to go back to Trump, Trump has, as we discussed before, Ms. Sam, enormous crossover appeal in the black community because of immigration. And, I mean, this is the immigration issue, I think, has the potential of taking a block of African American voters and not moving them into the Republican camp, but moving them into the independent camp, and that is why I think the Democrats and the Republican establishment, which cannot stand Trump, is going to make an all-out effort to destroy him, because if he does detach maybe a quarter of the African American vote from being automatic Democratic voters, he is the next president. It really is as simple as that, if he gets the nomination.
Yep.
And of course, if he gets the nomination, there are a lot of vested interests in the Democrat, in the Republican Party, especially the consultant class and the people who depend on a living for the donations of the establishment politicians and the purchases by the established politicians for their consulting services. Those people are facing a big economic hit because Trump does not need them.
Right.
So there is a lot of absolutely naked self-interest going on with all these people that you see on Twitter and Facebook from the I would call them the governing class within the Republican Party, who are just foaming at the mouth about Trump. He's vulgar, he's a buffoon, he's a clown, he's a racist, his supporters are Neanderthals, blah, 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 blah. You know, there is a lot of self-interest involved, and it's suicidal self-interest, because the way
right.
the demographics of the country are evolving, I mean, the Republican Party really needs somebody like Trump to make inroads into people who either haven't been voting or who have been voting Democratic.
And to interject really quick, it's not just with blacks, young people. I know a 21-year-old gentleman, white, who was enraptured with the debates and watched them from beginning to end and could not believe that he was watching the debate. But, of course, the reason why he was watching the debate was because of Trump. They want to see what he's saying next and what he's thinking and what he's talking about and what he's going to do. Now, that's young people. That's a 21-year-old white male who has never voted and is interested in the campaign. Okay, continue.
No, I mean, I basically run through the point, the points I wanted to make. There is a huge, you know, it's funny that you mentioned about not voting, because I was on a show last night as a guest, a call-in guest. A friend of mine has a radio show related to the Second Amendment, gun rights things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a gun guy, but they're friends of mine, so I call into their show and put my two cents
mm-hmm.
in. They're not talking about gun stuff specifically, and a lot of these guys are all veterans, and a lot of them just can't stand the idea of voting because they're so turned off by the political process. And, you run into these people all the time, like the gentleman that you just described, and, a lot of other people. Oh, I don't vote. It doesn't make a difference, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And as Trump comes along, and all of a sudden the audience for a Republican debate goes from 4 million to 23 million.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these people of the Republican Party saying, oh, he's a clown, he's a buffoon, he cannot win. And I'm like, what planet are you guys living on? I mean, maybe in the long run he'll fall on his face, but why don't you give him a chance? It's not as if the Republican Party has been doing such a bang up job winning presidential elections that you can afford to ignore him.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, I mean, my perception of it is that a lot of these people who are opinion makers within the party are deathly afraid of Trump for financial reasons, because he does not need them, and they make their living by providing consulting and media services to established mm-hmm. Republican politicians, like Romney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, who spent tens and tens of millions of dollars on crap in 2012. Voting, voter outreach that didn't reach voters, voter analysis that didn't predict turnout, you know, get out the vote drives that didn't get out and drive the votes.
mean, yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing about it is that, like you said, first-time voters or people who have been apathetic about the voting process are now engaged in it. Whatever their reasons for being engaged, you should be going with that, because maybe they tuned in for Trump, and maybe Trump doesn't say anything. But maybe they hear the other ideas on the dais, and maybe they hitch their wagons to some of the more favorable candidates. But that would not have happened if there wasn't the outrageous interest in the process, and you have to credit that to Trump. More to the point, Trump is an established name already, which goes to your point about them being, he doesn't need them. His name is on untold number of buildings. He has a TV show. More importantly, he is a product of the media. And that's what I wanted to talk about, is why the media will not be as effectual as they have been in the past, if at all. But he is from the media, so he knows how they work, and that is why he is able to manipulate them in the way that he has.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the great appeals of Trump for me is that, you know, he's been to this rodeo many, many times with the mass media, and he knows how to bait them. He knows how to get around them. And there are no surprises there. I mean, there isn't, you know, Romney got constantly upended by the successful media campaign against him. Whereas Trump, I mean, he's got his own brand image that is more powerful than anything that the media can do to defame him. And people mm-hmm. know what his baggage is. I mean, what is there to know about Donald Trump's personal life that wasn't already known years before
right.
he ever ran?
That isn't on a Wikipedia page somewhere, yes.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. I mean, his divorces. I mean,
right.
you know, for 30 years, just go into the New York Post archives. You'll find everything you want to about, you know, Donald and his wives and all the rest of it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there isn't anything to know about his business record or his personal life that isn't out there already. But Carly, where I think if people really started paying attention to her business record, which I'm sure Democratic opposition research people are doing as we speak, there is a lot that a lot mm-hmm. of the public doesn't know that they're going to find out, because
mm-hmm.
it's covered in the financial press, not the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean,
agree.
You know, after seeing the Donald on television with The Apprentice, and I actually was a big fan of the show, and then I got wrapped up in my own, you know, the things, and stopped watching pretty much
mm-hmm.
television altogether. But for a couple of years, I was a big Apprentice fan. I loved that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I learned quite a bit from it, not about business, but about human nature. So again, I mean, Donald Trump is a known quantity, and it drives
right.
crazy. I mean, you get on Twitter at night, And you run into what I call, you know, the post happy hour tweets, where, you know, it's 11 or 12 at night and people are just ranting and raving against Trump. You know, maybe with a few cupfuls of the grape or something, you know, powering them. They're just ranting and raving about how terrible he is, and he's a disgrace, he's a buffoon, he's a clown, he's a racist, he's this and he's that. And I'm like, we're living in two different universes.
Mhm. Oh yeah, very much so. They said it's a bubble. The establishment media, they live in this bubble. They shine each other's butts, and this right here is what, you know, we've been talking about for years. Since 2008. When I first called into your show, and when we were first on the, what was that one show? I forget the name. Where we?
Oh, yeah, unusable signal.
Yeah, unusable signal. All
that was
the way back.
The Tommy Christopher Caleb House show.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we I've said this for years that they have no real connection to the rest of America. It's only about politicking and the culture they've cultivated in Washington, where they just shine each other's butts. And now you see it. Everyone sees it. That they don't have any. That's why they don't understand it. That's why they can't. They don't get it. And that's why, you know, they've made themselves, they've marginalized themselves into insignificancy, the media itself, because you didn't do your job vetting Obama. And those people, such as myself, who are paying attention and not on the hope and change bandwagon, who are paying attention, that you weren't doing your job. And you've burned through all your goodwill, the capital of being the branch of government or outside branch of government that kept the checks and balances on the judicial, the Congress, and the presidency. You didn't do your job checking and balancing those things. You were too busy talking about making sure the presidency was a success, having shaking leg syndrome and all the rest of it. And now no one trusts you to tell them the truth. Now you supposedly want to do your job and vet individuals. Here comes a guy who is from the media, knows all about the media, and thus knows, like you said, how to duck and dodge you like a pro, right? And you guys are confounded. You are the reasons why he is able to surge every time you criticize him. Because nobody trusts you. It's like the boy who cried wolf. You've cried wolf for all these years. And now you supposedly want to tell the truth. I'm going to put that in air quotes. Because, like I said, no one trusts you, and no one believes you.
Well, you know, people see the evidence before their own eyes, because, you know, one of the great blackmail tools that the media has is accusations of racism, and all of a sudden they're running into this set of circumstances where on the issue of immigration, which, you know, Trump made a hot button issue, they're finding that huge numbers of both African Americans and Latinos And hitherto guilty white people have all decided, oh my God, this immigration thing is out of control, both the illegal part of it and the legal part where companies are shipping in massive quantities of visa holders with H-1B visas and displacing American workers, especially in industries like IT, with cheaper paid foreign immigrants who come here legally on H-1B visas. So all of a sudden, this huge segment of the American population crossing racial and ethnic boundaries is starting to look at immigration, and they're saying the system is broken, and the establishment line that immigration is wonderful and it has no downside, it's a crock.
Right.
And like you say, when the people, when they listen to media accuse Trump of being racist and bigoted because of his stance on immigration, and they see what the consequences of immigration the way we have it now on their own personal lives and job prospects, it has been a very remarkable development. And though I don't know if you caught those African American ladies who do the viewer's view on YouTube.
No, I'm not familiar. What about?
Yeah, you should check that out. They call themselves, stage names, kind of Diamond and Silk, and they have a YouTube channel called The Viewer's View. And after the first debate where, Megyn Kelly tried what she tried to sink Trump, they put out a video that went viral. It got over 1 million hits or something. And they've been producing videos, throughout the campaign. And, they're quite popular. They've appeared on television and stuff. And they are very energetic ladies. And they really cut to the chase about a number of things, from the African-American perspective. I mean, there's a little bit of theatrics involved, which there has to be if you do make YouTube hits. There, it is show business, even on YouTube. But they've made quite a splash. And to me, that's a symptom of how Trump is cutting into, at least for now, potential voters, both African Americans and also Latinos, because the problem with immigration is a real problem. It crosses all racial and ethnic boundaries. I mean, if you're a second generation Hispanic, the last thing you want is 1 million more people coming here from Mexico.
Exactly.
But the guilty white media in their gated communities with their affluent salaries, they just think, oh, well, you can't say anything about these people crossing the borders. It's not polite. It's not nice.
If those people were coming for their jobs, if those people were coming for Chris Matthews' jobs, you'd hear a whole different other take on it. But
oh, absolutely.
Like I said, these people know, just like Obama knows, that all the policies that they push forward, the political agenda that they have set forward for the rest of us unwashed mass, these things affect us. They don't affect them. But you better well believe that if they were coming for Megyn Kelly's job or any of the other people's job in the media, there would be a whole other tune being sung. And this is why I say the rest of us don't trust you to tell the truth, because you don't live in our reality. And more to the point, for so long, the media... For the longest time, the media would speak truth to power and report the news. Now the media speaks the truth to whatever power is in power, or whatever power they want to be in power, and they want to make the news. They want to be a part of history, and that's a problem. That's a problem. When you're not wanting to simply report on history, but to make history, then you're into the realm of propaganda. And then what use are you then? And this is where we are right now. And this is why no one trusts you. So if Donald Trump came out and said the moon was made of blue cheese, and the media said, oh, he said the moon, there's no scientific basis, even I would have to say, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe somebody should go and get a sample. Maybe it is made of blue cheese. Because the media has burned through the trustworthy that far, their trustworthy status that far. No one can trust them, even when they're quote-unquote telling the truth. This is their animal that they have made.
Yeah, I really think the media thinks that their job now is to help Barack Obama govern.
Right, and that has been. They said that. I mean, Chris Matthews said that. He literally said those words to, the Morning Joe or Joe Scarborough or whatever. He literally said, it's my job to make sure that this presidency is successful. Bam, end of discussion. That is what they believe.
And the thing, they're going to have a terrible hangover because this guy is going to be gone in a year.
Exactly.
And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, come inauguration day, whoever it is that takes over, you know, the reality is just going to come crashing in, you know, $20 trillion of debt. The Middle East in flames, Iran on its way to get a bomb, China and Russia expanding everywhere militarily, you know, Europe fending off a refugee crisis, you know, our borders not controlled, our economy weak, and stagnant, no growth economy. It's not a pretty picture that Obama is leaving behind, and all of a sudden the media is going to, you know, act outraged. And how did this happen? Who is to blame?
And more,
we will do investigative journalism and find out.
Yeah, right. I mean, that ship has sailed. Let me tell you something. The other thing is that the narrative that they have been pushing since from 2008. Or rather 2007, when Barack Obama came onto the national scene. And the narrative that they've been pushing is, why do you want to keep having old white people run everything? Now, look at the field now on the Democratic side. old white woman, potentially old white man, Barry Sanders, right?
Right.
Another potential old white man, if the rumors are true about Joe Biden. And you sat up there and like, oh, we're going to have, which was ironic considering you had old white man telling old white man, i.e. Chris Matthews, telling voters, why do we want to put more old white people in power? But anyway, you sat up there and you cultivated that message over I don't know how many years, and now look at the Democratic field. Old white people, as far as the eye can see. Don't you think that after you've cultivated that message to the Kool-Aid drinkers, obviously the rest of us don't care. We're not color struck. But you the Occupy Wall Street mentality and all that, oh, fight the power and all this other crap. You've cultivated this message of, why do we want to keep putting old white people in power, blah, blah, blah. And now you have a field of all old white people. Don't you think there's going to be a disconnect there for them? They're not going to be energized to go, no matter how much you say Barry Sanders is just surging in the polls for young people. Give me a break. You know,
well, I suspect
this
he
little
really
coalition is on
searching,
shaky ground.
In terms of the caucus-going crowd, the lefty, white, progressive caucus-going crowd that did so much for Barack Obama, because they made Obama's candidacy, I mean, the African-American voters, the minority voters, they sealed the deal in the general election, but the people who got Obama the nomination were white, lefty progressives. And they are behind, you know, Bernie surging, and like you say, I mean, I think this is Hillary's huge problem, because she has to, after the media, you know, dispensed all this Kool-Aid about identity politics, and now Hillary is going to have to go to the minority voters who have really taken just enormous hits in the Obama economy. And she has to tell them, I'm a populist. I identify with your problems. Good luck with that. You know, sitting in my foundation and jetting around the world on my foundation expense account, I got to really understand the problems of working minority people in the U.S. I mean, maybe some people will buy it, but I don't think so.
They push this narrative, like you said, of identity politics. And while, yeah, you're going to have the social justice warriors that are, like I said, the Kool-Aid drinkers that have never stopped gulping down the Kool-Aid, they're on board with Bernie, and they'll probably be on board with Joe, especially if Obama comes out and puts his stamp of approval on Joe or Bernie. I don't see him doing it for Clinton. I just do not.
No, he won't.
But the rest of the people, like you said, in the general, they're going to say, well, all I see are old white people everywhere. I'm not interested in that. Now, that's what you've cultivated with this whole, oh, we don't want to have Clintons and Bushes and Bushes and Clintons, and just aren't you tired of seeing the same faces? My face is different. Whatever it was he said during that election, basically implying I'm the person of color on this dais. The rest of them, you know, white people, as far as the eye can see, you are not going to generate the enthusiasm or what have you that people in the general had to vote for something different,
right.
i.e. voting for some person of color. You're not going to have that on the Democratic ticket. It's just not going to happen.
No, and so, you know what? And the first African-American president can only happen once. And
right.
it happened. So
right.
that kind of unique motivation to vote will never be around again.
Right.
And, you know, the Democrats, you know, they made a gamble when they picked somebody as young and inexperienced and as left as Barack Obama.
Exactly.
They made a gamble, and that gamble is going to come back to haunt them now.
Oh, absolutely.
Because outside of the Kool-Aid drinkers, the legacy is tarnished. I mean, everybody knows this administration has not worked. It's been a failure.
Absolutely. You know, they sit up there and, navel gazing. They're so quick to talk about how they painted themselves in a corner and they're the coalition and blah, blah, blah. But you have painted yourselves in corners because I don't identify with the Democratic Party. I haven't for the longest time, honestly, but, you know, I've never been a Democrat, but, so I'm not even going to start lying now. But really, I'm literally like running away from that wing of the party, like literally running, trying to find a place to hide. But more importantly, like people like my uncle who are Democrats, have voted for Democratic causes, and of course voted enthusiastically for Obama, not once but twice, are now in the position of saying, this is not the party for me. I don't, now, you all have painted yourselves into a corner as well. You're sitting up there talking about the Republicans. It's easy to talk about the Republicans, but you're not talking about what you have done to your own party. You are marginalizing people who have been Democrats for their entire lives, who are saying, this is not my party anymore. Within a few short years.
Yeah, well, the problem with the Republican Party there are a multiple of problems with the Republican Party, and I guess if I had to pick a couple of them, the two that really stand out is in the people who are actively involved with Republican politics. There is this enormous craving for respectability, which is what is driving their attacks on Trump, because they really think that if they bash Trump, then they will get a respectful hearing from their media betters. And, you know, my advice to them is forget about it. It's not going to happen for you. The media will never support Republicans for a variety of reasons. So stop trying to impress them with attacking Trump for his alleged bigotry and thus showing how tolerant you are. The media will not give you credit for it. So that's one big problem. Then the other problem are the quote, true conservatives, unquote, who, you know, value ideological purity and consistency among all things. Now, I am a conservative. I believe in limited government. I believe that you achieve limited government through evolution, by launching experiments in limited government, proving that they can work, and then once you've got some credibility with the voters, proposing other things which have a good chance of working. Mm-hmm. But what a lot of true conservatives do is they have a very ideological package, which is the minute we get power, we're going to shut this down and shut that down and shut this down and shut that down and outlaw this and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, you're scaring people. Shut up.
I know what you're saying. Like, and then the ones that are like, well, if they don't line up with 100% of what I believe, they don't get my vote. And I was like, you're not going to find anybody that's 100% what you believe. That's just, now you're getting into the fantastical.
Well,
you know,
millions
bring
of
it
voters,
back down to reality.
Millions of voters stayed home in 2012, and did not vote for Romney because some of them were evangelicals, and they'll never admit it, but they couldn't stomach the idea of a Mormon in the White House, so they didn't vote for him. And then the others were the true conservatives. Romney is too moderate, he's too this, he's too that, and you know, Romney had a lot of flaws as a candidate, but my God, he would have been so much better than what, you know, a reelected Obama, because we saw how leftward Obama lurched the minute he got reelected.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
All,
I mean, those
out
people.
Window, all of a sudden, he's for gay marriage. He's for gay this. He's for gay that. He's for, you know, massive immigration. He's for, unlegislated amnesty, you know, things he would never say in the campaign. The minute he got reelected and didn't have to face an election again, you know, he showed his true colors.
Well, that's what they all do, which is why I couldn't understand why people couldn't get behind Romney. Even myself, who I'm libertarian, of course I'm not going to think Romney is the pure conservative choice. Even I had to vote for him because I'm like, I'm not afraid of the unknown. I'm afraid of the known. I know that this guy who came in there doing the crazy crap that he did, once he doesn't have to face another reelection, That's when they let their truth, the politicians let their truth freak flag fly. They do whatever they want to do and can do, every fantastical thing they can do at the end of their presidency. I'm like,
Obama, like you say, I mean, he's got this vision of taking America down a peg.
Right.
So when he lost the midterm elections of 2014, what does he do? He doubles down on legal amnesty.
Exactly.
And this is what the true conservatives do not understand. And I cannot tell you how many times I've had this battle with people in our movement about the need to strategically plot a course to get you through the times that we are living in. Because we've got this all-or-nothing brigade that is just adamant about, they're not getting my vote if they don't deserve it. I'll stay home. And like,
well, what you should say to them is this is as much your fault as it is the people who are actually doing the policy. Because the fact that you abstain for whatever reasons, a good conscience, whatever, I can't in good conscience vote for this person. They don't align with my beliefs 100% and blah, blah, blah. And here we are. You are still having to live in the same trash pile heap with the rest of us that did hold our noses and vote. So what is the difference? What difference did you really make here? All you did was keep the guy that you knew was going to go off the rails once he secured his reelection. And now he can go and retire and do whatever, get his millions of dollars like the Clintons, running around the world giving speeches. And the rest of us have to live here in the crap.
Yeah, and we're stuck with it. And like I said, it is just, you just want to bang your head against the wall when you run into that mentality of, voting makes a difference. It doesn't solve all of life's problems. It's just a step in the right direction. That's all you get in this world. So, I don't know.
Exactly.
I guess, this has been a great discussion. I'm glad you were able to drop in. I'm going to be doing not a show every Sunday, but a show maybe every couple of weeks, and some of them will obviously be political. So, feel free to drop in. We're almost out of time. So, I enjoyed reconnecting after all this time.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So I'm going to kind of exit the scene here for our archive listeners. We'll also, our chat listeners, thank you for dropping by. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. For people listening in archive, I will repeat my message. Follow the campaign. Pick the guy that you want to vote for. Vote for him or support him. Do not let people try to talk you out of your convictions or shame you or manipulate you or emotionally blackmail you to not voting or not supporting the person of your choice. And on that note, I will close it down. Ms. M, thanks very much. Larry, thank you for dropping by. And for our archive listeners, thank you as well. Have a great weekend, what's left of it.